Support for this podcast comes from Frito-Lay and the 2023 Snack Bracket Championship. The Frito-Lay Snacker Challenge is underway, and fans are voting on their favorite snacks to crown champion. We're talking about primetime matchups between the best 64 snacks in the land. Will Ruffles Ridges reign supreme? Can Doritos defend their dynasty? Or will Smart Food use their smarts for a surprise upset? Only you can decide. Get in on all the action for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks. Let your snacks be heard. Just go to FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com to vote and enter for a chance to win. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends April 3rd, 2023. Void where prohibited. Year's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
Hey, everyone. This is Lash Jackson of Detroit Bad Boys, and on this week's podcast, Ben Gulker and I talk about your 1-2 Detroit Pistons. Ben and I go over the bench's struggles offensively, what we've loved about Jaden Ivey and Jalen Duren, and what Sadiq Bey's role on this team is with Bojan Bogdanović alongside him. As always, we appreciate your continued support of the podcast. The best way to do that is to share, subscribe, and leave comments. Please leave comments on the discussion post on Detroit Bad Boys. That's the best way for us to have the conversation that we want to have around the podcast. In order to do that, though, you have to follow DetroitBadBoys.com, which you should be doing, because it's the best place on the internet for Pistons news and analysis this season. With all that said, it's time to go to work. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of the Detroit Bad Boys podcast. I am your host, Lazarus Jackson, pleased, as always, to be joined by my usual co-host, Ben Gulker. Ben, we have actual games to talk about. How's it going?
Hey, Les. Yeah, we got some games, and we're kind of where we thought we'd be, which is...
Not great.
Not great. Some fun, some bad. But yeah, we got some games to talk about, so that's good.
Yeah. I figured... I wanted to go super duper simple for the first three games just because the sample size is so small, but we are seeing some trends that are good and some things that are less good. Pistons are obviously 1-2, a rough loss to the Indiana Pacers last night. But something that I enjoyed seeing that I think has that continued in the Pacers game was the ball movement. The Pistons have, I think they showed last night, they have like a 70% assist rate on the team. Like most 70% of the team's baskets have been assisted. Like that was top five in the league. That continued last night. There's no one dominant assist like giver. Like it's not just Cade. It's not just Jaden Ivey. Jaden Ivey has been much better as a distributor than I expected. And Cade is averaging 7 assists a game. But like they had like 30 assists against the Magic. They had like 26 assists against the Pacers. The ball moves really well, and that's something that I was afraid we would not see as much with a young team. The other thing is we're seeing a lot more like this is a coaching thing I've noticed. There's a lot more cuts, right? Like this is a function of having like Jaden Ivey, you know, relentless off-ball athletic guy on the roster. But when you see guys like Isaiah Livers and like Killian Hayes like scoring off cuts in the Pacers game, you know that that's something that they're coaching. That's something that they've been emphasizing from an offensive standpoint as a way to get easier shots. Ben, what have you been thinking about what have you noticed about the ball movement as we've seen the Pistons play in these first three games?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would give some credit to Jaden Ivey. Jaden's been a lot of fun to watch. I'm ready to start. Cooking up some crow, I will say. I've had a lot more fun watching Jaden Ivey than I anticipated. He's just a joy to watch with the basketball, especially in transition. He does plenty of rookie guard stuff, himself into plenty of trouble. So not to say he's been flawless, but with respect to the offense in the half court, he breaks down the defense a lot off the dribble. I know that sounds cliche, but he does a lot of that. And I think at the team level, they've done a good job of making the second and third pass, swinging the ball around the perimeter, which has been impressive. And then I think they have guys who are particularly high IQ. Like you mentioned, Livers. I think Bogdanović is really good at this. Killian is obviously a guy who's good at this. And then they've got, you know, in the second unit, a guy like Duren, who's just, you know, where his basketball IQ is at right now is hard to tell, but he can finish just about anything, right? Like, I mean, throw the ball up in the air and he's going to potentially finish stuff, or he's going to get a put back dunk on something. So I think you've just got the right mix of a couple guys, Cade, Ivy, Killian, who are good at getting into the paint. You've got that in the first and second unit. You've got guys who are really smart, Bogdanovich, Livers, Sadiq, and then of course Cade and Ivy in terms of basketball IQ. And that gives you the right mix of stuff that I don't think the Pistons have had before. And Laz, I think you're right to point out that it's resulting in ball movement, particularly the second and third pass, if it's dribble penetration and a kick out, and lots of stuff happening off the ball in terms of cuts and backdoors. And, you know, it'll be interesting if Bagley gets back as well, how that plays in, because I think we'll get obviously another lob threat as well. So yeah, I agree. That's a surprising but definitely pleasant result out of the first three.
No, absolutely. Ivy is averaging 6 assists a game, which is, like we talked about, a lot more playmaking than I think we were expecting when he was initially drafted. And the thing that's sticking out to me is that he's not making like the most difficult reads he's ever like made in his life, but he is doing a really good job of just like getting it to the open man, right? Like leveraging his athleticism to collapse the defense and like kicking it out from there. You talked about the rookie guard stuff. He does do a little bit of that too, where he'll drive, he'll hit the baseline and he'll be like, okay, like I'm under the basket. Like, I don't know what's going on now.
I'm not
going
to go.
Yeah. But you know, if he does that 3 times, like one time he'll score, one time he'll get a nice kick out, and one time he turns the ball over, like 2 out of 3 times, like you take it. And eventually he will learn to even lessen that. And so you like to see that initially as a point of development. 6 assists, but 3.7 turnovers a game.
Yeah.
For Jaden Ivey.
That's not good. Yeah. The turnover rate's way too high. The other thing is, I think getting out in transition is helping with assist rate too. Shockingly, the Pistons are in the top third of the league, 11th. NBA.com has them 11th overall in pace, which is surprising. I've kind of joked about Jaden Ivey forcing, you know, like pulling Casey into the modern NBA age single-handedly. But, you know, I think certainly he's one of the reasons the Pistons are high in pace, and I think transition opportunities often lead to assisted bucket, right? So that, that helps too, I think.
No, absolutely. The next thing that's like really stood out to me is how much better the offense moves with Bojan Bogdanovic. That was a very nice acquisition by Troy Weaver. Yeah, he's made a ton of shots. He's 4-10 from 3 against Indiana, 6-10 for 3 against Orlando. Like, no, he's not going to make 6 threes every single night, but that level of shooter and having that level of like off-ball threat and leveraging him like off curls and stuff is something that the Pistons like have not had in such a long time. I haven't felt like this confident in a guy shooting since like when like Reggie Bullock and Blake Griffin were doing like DHO magic for like that 6-week stretch a couple of years back. He's driven the basket really well. He gets kind of caught sometimes in between with the lack of athleticism. We saw this in the Pacers game. Pacers blocked everybody at the rim, Bojan included. But he gets out in transition. He had a couple of nice coast-to-coast finishes against the Knicks. You could see like the smoke coming out of Thibodeau's ears when like Bojan Bogdanovic goes coast to coast on his defense. But yeah, I've been really impressed with Bojan. That's everything I wanted in a signing. The only thing that scares me a little bit is that he's not playing enough. They're tinkering with the lineups. We'll get to the bench in a little bit, guys. Trust me. But it seems like he should be playing a lot more than he is. What are you taking away from Bojan's performance so far, Ben?
Well, I agree with everything you said. I think one of the things is when you're that good of a shooter, it just goes to show like when you command that level of respect, like a simple pump fake can just do wonders for your ability to get to the rim. Like I can recall one, I was just watching the fourth quarter of the Indiana game before we're recording, Laz, and there's one possession at the end, in the end of the fourth quarter where 3 guys run it. Bogey and he pump fakes and all 3 guys fall for the fake. And it's like when you're that good of a shooter, just moving your hands 2 inches can just do wonders. So You know, like Sadiq, if you could just find that 38% 3-point shooting consistently for 40 games, like that's just going to open up everything else for your offense. Like, cause when you're that good, it just does wonders for you. And so I agree. I think I underestimated how good he was going to be shooting the basketball. And I knew he was crafty, but my goodness, he really is crafty. That's just the best way to explain it. His minutes, I think, I mean, he's old, right? I mean, he's old.
Yeah, so maybe they're
just trying to manage for the long haul and keep him healthy. That'd be my comment there.
Yeah. I, like you mentioned Sadiq, and the thing I really like about Bojan is how he's made what Sadiq has to offer this team from the starting lineup a lot simpler, right? Like with Bojan out there as the floor spacing guy who can also drive to the basket, Sadiq can focus a little bit more on his interior game, which is something that I think he's done a good job of so far. Sadiq's only shooting 33% from three. And again, like the whole theory of Sadiq is that he can do a lot of the stuff Bojan does, but he needs to be a better shooter to actually leverage a lot of this. But Sadiq is really improved as he's simplified on like what he does as a driver, right? It's a lot of like, I am going to go to the rim. I'm going to get fouled. I'm seeking out contact so that I can get fouled, because getting free throws is easier for me than like elevating and finishing over like bigs. He's shooting almost 5.5 free throws a game, which is like double or not double. He shot 3 free throws a game last season, but like that's a big increase in free throw attempts for Sadiq per game. But again, like he's shooting 33% from three. He had I think he went 2-for-8 against the Pacers, and he only shot like 8 times against the Magic. And so it still kind of ebbs and flows with Sadiq. But Bojan being out there as a consistent floor spacer, as a consistent off-ball movement like threat, is like, okay, now we don't need as much of that from Sadiq, and it opens up the areas of his game that I like. The other thing I'll say is that like the defense has not been great, and I think Bojan and Sadiq are guilty of that as anyone. But I did like the way Sadiq competed against Banchero in that Orlando game. Like, yes, Banchero had like 26, 7-7. Like he got his, but I felt like Sadiq was making him work for it. So Ben, what are we to do with Sadiq? Are we to just like enjoy the fact that like he's shooting like 2 more free throws a game and he hasn't missed a free throw yet? Or are we just going to bemoan the 33% from three and just continue to hope that like he eventually just shoots the ball better? Like what do we do with Sadiq?
Yeah. I mean, I can't write off his rookie season, right? As 3-point shooter, when you put together that body of work for an entire season, like there has to be a there for a shooter. So I'm inclined to just be a little more patient and hope that shooting comes back around. I think he's still kind of finding his way a little bit in terms of where to position himself for 3-point attempts. Bogdanović, he shoots the ball with so much confidence, and he never flinches or hesitates when he catches the ball. Like when he catches the ball, he's looking to shoot instantly. Sadiq to me does not look to have that level of confidence in his 3-point shot right now. I am a big believer in being confident in shooting the basketball. I think that matters. And I don't know that Sadiq has that right now. I'd like to see him, he shot, like you mentioned, he did shoot the ball 8 times. So it's not like he's not shooting, but I don't know. He doesn't look like he believes in his shot the way he did as a rookie.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see him get out of his own head a little bit and believe that he can hit shots, because I still think he can. So what do we do with him? I think patience is key, because I just don't think that rookie season is a fluke yet. I'm just not inclined to believe that.
No, definitely. I think there's something there when you mention his confidence. Not to say that he's not confident in his shot, but it is really clear that he's putting a lot of work during these off seasons, like into his floor game. And so you do kind of see him catch and be like, okay, like this, the thing I worked on all season was like one jab go. Like, is it time to one jab go? And like, by the time you give the jab and the defense like steps back, it's like, okay, like, well now am I shooting? Am I going? Like, am I passing? And so like you can see how the work he's put in during the summer has been good for his floor game, but it's also kind of, it's still making the gears turn in his head. Whereas his rookie year, like his role was like, go out there and shoot because we only have like two guys in the starting lineup who can shoot. And so I hope that he just like cuts down on the decision tree a little bit. He starts to have that instinctual, what my decision is going to be before I catch the ball. But we're also seeing, like you mentioned with Boyan, like three dudes are flying at Boyan because he's shooting 50% from three on the season. If Sadiq continues to shoot 33% from three on the season, guys are going to close out on him, you know, hard, but a little less desperate than they are in a guy who's shooting 50% from three. And so he's going to need to be able to just like pull over those soft closeouts and make those shots in order to get to the parts that he's worked on, the floor game, the free throw drawing, etc. It's been interesting to me to think about like what we do with Sadiq when what they clearly want to do is like play two bigs instead of two wings. We've seen some Duren Isaiah minutes. There was talk of like starting Marvin Bagley before his injury. And if you have Cade, Jaden Ivey, and two bigs on the floor, what you really need from that last starter spot is a dead eye shooter. And like Boyan has been a better shooter so far in his career than Sadiq is. But it feels weird to go like, okay, we need a lob threat, so we're going to start Marvin Bagley. So Sadiq Bey, like you're coming off the bench, right? Like, yeah, you guys missed the Ben head shake. He's like, nah, I'm not having that.
Not for Marvin Bagley.
I agree, but it seems like philosophically, two bigs is where they want to be, and that leaves a little bit of like you can't play six guys, right? You can only play five.
Yeah.
I was texting about this with Bryce, and he was like, yeah, like I'm not confident enough to say that Sadiq should come off the bench yet. But if they play two bigs and they feel like they have to play two bigs, like that is the logical person to bring off the bench, and that feels weird for it makes sense, but it also feels weird for as much emphasis we've put on Sadiq for his play like over his first three seasons. It feels weird to like relegate him to a bench role so soon.
It would be such a strange demotion too when you think about philosophically where Dwayne Casey has been in terms of you earn your place in the rotation through consistent defense and buying mm-hmm. in, et cetera. I mean, has there been a guy who's bought in defensively more than Sadiq Bey? I mean, I don't know. Like, maybe Killian? I don't know. It'd be pretty hard. I mean,
it's like, has Marvin Bagley bought in
exactly
more than Sadiq
Bey? That's like, point. Like, if there's point 1A, that's point 1B, right? Like, you're going to elevate Bagley to into more. Like, I don't know. That's a hard, that's a tough sell. That's a really tough sell.
Yeah. I mean, clearly they want to play Stu and Duren together in time, right? And they don't, it's like Nerlens Noel's not really ready to play yet, and Bagley's hurt, so like they can't really do it right now. But I get the theory of it, right? Like Stu has been really good on the interior, and he did get embarrassed by Tyrese Haliburton a couple times on the switches, but he is a solid switch defender. And then you have Jalen Duren kind of hanging back, protecting the rim, rebounding everything in sight. We're going to talk about Jalen Duren now. Jalen Duren rebounds the ball real well, dunks real good. But also he finally did the thing against the Knicks where he had like three fouls in like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like that's going to happen. But Ben, we were really high on Jalen Duren like coming into the season. We've seen nothing so far to dissuade us from that. When do we start expanding Jalen Duren's role, right? Like, when do we get Jalen Duren into the starting lineup? Like, when do we, because that's clearly where they're headed, but like how long is it going to take?
As soon as he figures out team defense, right? Like,
right.
I don't know. It probably depends on which feed, which broadcasters you had for the New York game, because I had the New York broadcasters and it was hilarious. I mean, they were singing Jalen Duren's praises when it was the Pistons on offense, but they were just straight up making fun of him on defense, and it was actually pretty funny. But yeah, I mean, he was just completely lost defensively in the New York game, and it just led to so many. Well, the three fouls was pretty funny, but then when he did get extended minutes, he was guarding no one, right? I mean, there were opportunities where he was guarding nobody, and it led to very easy buckets for New York. So, yeah, I mean, I during game one on Twitter, I mean, if Jalen Duren started, if he got starters minutes, he's capable of averaging a double-double right now, right? I mean, I think going into game three, he was averaging a double-double. If he got starters minutes and stayed out of foul trouble, he would average a double-double. I also think, however, that that double-double would mask the fact that the team defense would be pretty abysmal. I mean, he would get some pretty spectacular blocks like he's already had. He'd swat stuff off the backboard. He'd probably get some interesting steals in the passing lane that would lead to fast breaks. But it would be all about the team defense. Would he be capable of making the right rotation so that the help defense isn't completely broken down? Is he capable of making the right reads in the pick and roll, et cetera? So that's where it's at for Jalen Duren right now. I love watching him play. You never know what exciting thing is going to happen. Put back dunks, alley-oop dunks, blocks off the backboard. I mean, he's just a pure piston big man. I am ecstatic that he's on the team. Love watching him. It's simply a matter of learning how to defend at the NBA level in the team context. When he figures that out, man, sky's the limit.
Yeah. I remain hopeful that they'll simplify the defense when he's on the floor to help facilitate that. You could see definitely sometimes in the New York game in particular, it's like, okay, we're doing it. It's like, okay, the action's happening on the perimeter, but we're running like stack or some Spain pick and roll stuff, or running some like off green stuff. And it's like Jalen Duren has to navigate that because they're switching everything. And so he has to know when to switch and who to switch on and what are the rules behind that. And then the ball's coming at him and he's like, oh crap. Like it's time to do rim protector stuff. And it's like, oh, nope. You like your man's gone. Yeah. Like goodbye.
Yeah.
So I do hope they just have him focus on the rim protector stuff. We saw a little bit of this against Memphis, and I thought we saw more of it against the Knicks than in the other two games, where they would switch 1 through 4 and just kind of let Stewart and Duren kind of hang back. I do think that is the best way for them to run their defense moving forward, but I understand that it puts a lot of burden on the other perimeter defenders to work a lot harder on defense, but I think that's a worthy sacrifice to help Jalen Duren like be the best defender he can be. Because clearly, like, go ahead, Ben.
I was gonna say, because he gives you so much. Yeah. I mean, it's a worthy sacrifice. Like you make your perimeter guys work a little bit because he just gives you so much raw productivity.
Yeah. And the Pacers killed them on the offensive glass because they started switching 1 through 5. And Jalen Duren is like attacking closeouts and like trying to, I don't know what he's like. He's doing the double hand jump on closeouts. It's like, okay, that's a little weird, but we'll go with it. But then like Goga Batadze is like underneath the rim, getting like 7 offensive rebounds or whatever. And it's like, yeah, this you can't live like this. The rebounding has been an issue through all 3 games, and Jalen Duren is such an excellent rebounder that you don't want to have him standing away from the paint. When you're trying to protect the glass.
Today's episode is brought to you by Cars.com. With over 2 million vehicles and 50,000 more added every day, Cars.com will match you with the perfect car for you, your budget, your life, your style. And if you're ready to say goodbye to your current car, Cars.com will get you an instant offer to cash it in. Just start by entering your license plate and get matched with a local dealer who will write you the check. So whether you're looking to buy or sell, just go to Cars.com. It's magical.
Yeah, let's talk about the defense, actually, Ben. The defense has not been good through 3 games. They've stuck with the switching scheme. I guess I should ask you, do you think the switching scheme has been more, more miscommunications between guys on, like, when to switch or, like, what actions we're switching or like who's got who, or do you think it's more like guys are just getting blown past in isolation, like once the switch occurs?
That's such a good question, Laz. I mean, the Indiana game is fresh in my mind.
Fair.
And I'm thinking particularly about the fourth quarter, third and fourth quarter, where Ben Math and Halliburton just like went nuts on threes. And like, I don't even know if that was due to switching. I mean, those guys, they just went nuts. They just made three after three after three after three. The New York game, I feel like some of it was guys just getting blown by. Some of it was for sure just getting blown by. But I'm thinking of a couple possessions in the Indiana game in the second half in particular where I felt like, and it's hard to talk about this without visuals, but I feel like some of the switches by default end up putting guys in really bad angles where if you were working harder to just stay in front of your man as opposed to thinking about the switch, you'd be working harder to put yourself in a better angle to cut off the guy's direct path to the basket, if that makes sense. So I guess it's a long way of answering your question. I feel like there are certain instances where guys are switching because that's what they're supposed to do. They feel like that's what they're supposed to do, so they do it. But by default, it's putting them in a really awkward defensive position that they would not, you would never put yourself in that sort of defensive position if you were just playing normal straight up man to man defense. And as a result, you're fighting against what your normal instincts would be. And guys are just getting to the basket super easily as a result. And again, it's hard to do this without like some screenshots or some videos, but that's my take on what's happening. And I think like, probably the New York game is an example of this. It's just leading to breakdown after breakdown after breakdown of guys getting to the paint where there's just no reason for them to have gotten into the paint in the first place. And depending on the team you're playing, that's either going to lead to easy looks at the rim or it's going to lead to kick out wide open threes. And I think against New York, it was probably both. Mm-hmm. Depending on which perimeter player, because the Knicks have got guys who can do either one of those things, right?
Yeah.
And the Knicks made a lot of threes as a result of dribble penetration. The defense has to collapse and kick out for a wide open look. And to me, it's just obvious. Like, I feel like any I don't mean to say this as condescending as it's going to sound, but I feel like any high school level coaching staff would look at this tape and think, this is not working. We are giving up wide open three after wide open three after wide open three. We can't do this. We just can't do this. And it just seems patently obvious to me that they have to change the scheme. It's just clear to me. It's not working the way. Whatever outcome they're trying to get, it can't be this, right? It can't be this, in my opinion.
I agree. I think when you were talking about the angles that ball handlers are getting because of the switching, I'm thinking about the possessions in which, like, there was one possession in the Knicks game where in anticipation of the switch, like, they start to kind of back off. And then you'll have like an RJ Barrett, like reject the screen that's coming that would like start the switch. And then because he rejects it, it's like, well, the guy's already leaning that way. It's like, well, now he's just got like a clear path to the rim.
That's exactly it. That's exactly what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. And it's like you have to defend harder up to the point at which you switch. You can't just like lazy switch. I feel like there have been a lot of lazy switches. The other thing that like I philosophically do not like about switching is that it playing this way on purpose just like pulls your worst defenders into the action, which is like not the point of having your worst, like anything that pulls your worst defenders like into the thing that like makes them bad is like not where I want to be. But when you have like Tyrese Halliburton like calling up Jaden Ivey's guy so that he can get the switch on Ivy, or have him calling up like Stu so he can get around, because he knows he can get around Stu. And once he does, like, he knows he has free reign to do whatever he wants. Or he's just going to step back three on him like twice in a row in the fourth quarter. And so they once you as an offense know that your action will cause a defensive reaction and you can plan around that, I don't feel like that's, I feel like defense should be dictating offense, not the other way around. If as a defense, if you're reacting, you're like already kind of losing. And so I do think they need to be, it's like, if they are going to stick with this scheme, which I agree with you, Ben, I would not do this. I would play more drop, but like, that's just me. But if they are going to stick with the scheme, they're going to have to be more aggressive with the switching and not just switch unnecessarily. Feel like if you're just bringing up Jaden Ivey's guy with like 17 seconds on the shot clock, just so like you can like dribble at Jaden Ivey, it's like, fight around that. It's like, right. Like don't give them the switch they want, like, you know, hedge and recover and get back to your guy. But yeah, I'm not, the defense has been bad. And the other thing is that, when they switch 1 through 5, again, we talked about this a little bit with Jalen Duren, but like when they switch 1 through 5, they are pulling their bigs out to the perimeter, and the rest of the team, like Sadiq, God bless him, like Kadeet competes on the glass, but like the rest of the team is like not big enough to secure the rebound and end the defensive possession, right? Like that's something that you said in the past, Ben. It's, yeah, just like, as a defense, your job isn't done until like you secure the rebound. And like we saw in the Indiana game, they were able to get back in that game, get into a rhythm on offense, because they were able to get 3 possessions in a row on like a single trip down the court because they got so many offensive rebounds. So you absolutely just like can't have that. It's been not good through 3 games, and I'll be very curious to see, because this is not a high school level coaching staff, right?
No, exactly. Exactly. These are smart men.
Adjustments they make.
They are smarter than me. there's clearly a rationale and an outcome they're hoping for that is not happening, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's the thing. These are not stupid people. These are very smart, highly intelligent people. The outcome they're striving for is not happening, and it didn't happen all preseason. They didn't get it consistently a season ago. They're not getting it through 3 games. So,
yeah. I think that's the thing that's like more bothersome, is that like, it could be more excusable. It's like, oh, Jaden Ivey's played 3 NBA games. Like, of course he doesn't have NBA defense down. Like, oh, Jalen Duren's played 3 NBA games. Like, of course he doesn't have NBA defense down. But they did this all last year. Like, right. Cade was here all last year. Sadiq was here all last year. Boyan's been in the NBA for like 12 years at this point. Like, they, so this is. Yeah, this should be scheme stuff. Yeah. Let's stop talking about the starters. Let's talk about the other bad thing. The bench. The bench has been awful. Yeah, oh my struggle. Gosh.
Yep.
I think the worst part about the bench to me is getting relieved, because Kevin Knox is no longer in the rotation. Isaiah Livers is back.
Yep.
That was big. Knox was
rough stuff.
Shooting a lot and missing a lot. It's like those two things don't go together very well. The other thing is Killian Hayes has not been as effective as he was in the preseason running the bench offense. He made like 1-3 last night, but yeah, he just like hasn't been able to dictate terms of the bench lineup the way you would have liked. They do have a built-in excuse, right? Up until last night, Isaiah Livers wasn't playing. That was a big part of their bench lineups. Alec Burks and Marvin Bagley, like, still injured. Marvin's going to be injured for a while. They were going to rely on those guys to come in and provide a lot of offense for those bench lineups. And you do, it's like, when you have a bench lineup of, like, Kevin Knox and Hamidou Diallo, like, you don't have any shooting, and that's kind of compressing things. But with that said, like, the bench can't play this bad offensively, and you expect to be able to stay in games from an offensive standpoint.
Yeah, excluding Rodney Magruder, who's played 5 minutes this season, Kevin Knox per 100 possessions leads the team in field goal attempts, which is absolutely ridiculous, and is shooting 14% from the field. So your bench unit's going to struggle. When, you know, you've got the worst shooter on the team taking More shots than anybody else on the team. So your bench, 39, offensive rating of 39. One of the lowest I've ever seen.
Out of 40?
Right, exactly. Exactly. Your bench unit's going to struggle. So Kevin Knox, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, things not working out. You know, you mentioned Killian. If this is the make or break season for Killian, he's not started it on the right trajectory. Hopefully things turn around. You know, Kojo doing Kojo things, you know, he manages to make shots, which helps bails the bench out of being completely unplayable. But Isaiah Livers coming back, that's got to help some, right? I mean, he continues to be Isaiah Livers, which is helpful. Hopefully he adds some shooting. The ball's got to go in the basket somehow. But, yeah, I mean, Jalen Duren's been the only fun thing to watch about that second unit. It's been ugly. And when the second unit has been out there, I mean, Indiana made its run against mm-hmm. the second unit. And, I mean, they just never really recovered. Pistons never were really able to recover. The first starters were never able to really close the gap against the two main runs that happened against the second unit and both of those big stretches. So not much redemptive to say, unfortunately.
Yeah. It is very noticeable to me that the game in which the bench collectively played the best is the game that they've won.
Yeah,
right.
True. Yep. That's
Kojo okay. Kojo had like 11 against Orlando. Jalen Duren had the double double. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like that. That's basically all they needed to be able to seal the game is like a little bit of something mm-hmm. From those bench lineups. Yes, Isaiah Livers should help, but Isaiah Livers is not like the Bojan of the bench where he's going to be putting up like 6, 7, 8 threes a game. They need him to space the floor, but like he is not that he hasn't shown himself to be like that level of like volume shooter. Correct. So he'll help from a scheme standpoint. Like defenses will have to play Isaiah Livers differently than they played Kevin Knox. But honestly, they should just tell Isaiah Livers to shoot as much as Kevin Knox is. Apparently, just take those open shots.
Lead the team and shoot shot attempts.
I mean, like if Livers is going to shoot like you know high 30s, low 40s from three. I would take it, might as well. Killian's done the super annoying thing where you look down at the end of the game, and I think he has like 11 turnovers and two, or he has 11 assists and 2 turnovers through 3 games, and so you look at the stat sheet and you're like, man, he had you know 5 rebounds, 5 assists, like all of like 4 blocks and steals, but like he shot like 1 for 9. And you're just like, I don't know what to do with this, right? It did seem noticeable in the Indiana game that he was playing more of an off-ball role. They were letting Kojo bring the ball up the floor a lot more. Killian is standing in the corner. He made a 3 that way. So, like, again, if they believe that the shooting tweaks that he's made will work out, then, like, that's a reason to operate like that. But... He still does good enough things from a playmaking perspective. He just needs to put the ball in the hoop more, which is what we've been saying about him for his entire NBA career. Mm-hmm. You're right in that, like, if this is a make or break season for him, this is not the way I'm sure he would have wanted it to start. But the team still has you know 45 games before trade deadline. Figure out what to do with this guy. Yeah. And then last but not least from the stuff that like has not gone as well, and it's taken us 36 minutes to get here, but we should probably talk about this a little bit more, is Cade. Mm-hmm. Cade Cunningham has been fine. This has not been the second year leap we were hoping for from Cade, right? Mm-hmm. He's been productive. He's averaging 18 points, 4 rebounds, and 7 assists. That's kind of in line like with what his numbers were last year. But he's shooting less than 40% from the floor. He needed that big stretch in the fourth quarter against Indiana to get to 35% from three. Before that, he had been shooting like sub 30% from three. Still not getting to the line as much as we would like. And he is still not showing the level of aggression consistently throughout the entirety of the game that we were talking about in preseason, Ben. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I agree that the the outputs, right, the raw stats are about where they were a season ago, which is interesting. The shooting is right about in line. The three-point percentage is a little bit up. Two-point percentage is a little bit down. True shooting percentage is still, you know, right around 50%, which is objectively not good. I was hoping to see a spike, but again, three games could be a little bit of a slump. The thing that is so interesting to me, Laz, is he's still like the fourth quarter superhero kind of guy. Like, interestingly, like right behind Kevin Knox in field goal attempts per 100 possessions is Cade, which surprised me. Like, I did not expect to see that. Yeah. But I think it's like he waits till the fourth quarter, which is just really interesting. He seems to just defer, and then just kind of come along strong in the fourth quarter, which is just seems to be how he approaches the game so much. And he's just still that way. He's still kind of doing that thing to me. And it feels like Indiana in particular, it just feels like it was too late. Like, I wanted him to just assert a little bit more a little earlier. And, you know, he didn't. You know, he was able to do that against Orlando, I think. He was able to assert a little bit, and it was enough to get past a team like Orlando. You know, Indiana had enough counter punches and Ben Math and Halliburton to, I think, hold that off from Cade as he started cooking late. So I'd like to see him maybe take some punches earlier still.
What I saw against Indiana, at least, was that he tried to be aggressive a little bit earlier, but the rim protection from Indiana, or the length and athleticism, gave him a lot of trouble.
That's right? You're right.
He got blocked multiple times in the paint, and that kind of dissuaded him from moving forward. So it's like, yes, it was good to see him hit the threes. And I do think he did a much better job in the fourth quarter getting to like his spots in like the like 8 to 15 foot range, like not quite the rim, but like not quite the wing, where he's like he's able to hit like his turnarounds, or like he's able to hit those pull up mid rangers off of like a couple like hesitation dribbles that he likes to be able to hit. So it's like he will find a way to get it going, I think. But it's going to be tough to be as efficient and draw as many fouls as we would like him to draw and be as efficient as we would like him to be if he's going to consistently be asked to finish like over and around like super athletic shot blockers. Part of that, I think, we can kind of lay at the feet of Isaiah Stewart in particular. Cade and Jaden have hit Isaiah Stewart with like some really nice passes, and is just Stewart takes a long time to load up, or he'll do like the power dribble and try and go up from there, or he'll do his backspin into like the hook shot. And just, all of his moves give the defense time to recover in a scenario in which like everything's very compact and like you don't want to give the defense time to recover. It's like with more of a lob threat in the lineups with Cade and Jaden Ivey, you would see defenses like have to pay more attention to that guy opening up things for Cade and Jaden Ivey. But with that said, like Cade like shot like 4 of 8 from 3, I think, against Indiana, but like needed that to get to 35% because he had shot so poorly from 3 in the first two games. Yeah. It always seems like his first shot is a 3. And it's like, you should just go to the rim more, my guy. Yeah, it's been, and like you mentioned, when I looked at the numbers, I was surprised to see the averaging 7 assists. Like I felt like Jaden Ivey had been more productive as a distributor than Cade had over the first 3 games, but Cade is obviously averaging more assists. But a lot of those have just been like flow of the offense stuff, right? Or off-ball stuff for Boyan, who's been on fire. And so I'll be curious to see if they can get a little bit more production from that big man spot. I hope that offsets some of the offensive slowdown they're going to get when Boyan is like no longer shooting 50% from 3, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it'll be fascinating to see. One thing is, let's put it this way. It'll be really fascinating to see if they don't play Duren and Stewart a lot together. It'll be interesting to see how Cade performs with Stewart versus with Duren. You know, the point you're getting at, Laz, is will it be easier for Cade to score efficiently in and around the paint with the lob threat there versus Stewart? Because I think you're right. I mean, Stu does take a long time to load up, and he's not a lob threat. Although he did have a couple lobs, though, not from Cade. But he's not a lob threat. He's just not a vertical guy. That's not who he is. A few people looked at that last year, but there was just such a small chunk of time where Bagley was around. And there were some encouraging numbers where Cade's two-point efficiency went up when he was playing with Bagley. But there's, again, it was just such a small chunk of time. And so I think this will be really interesting to revisit. Does Cade, in particular, because I think you're right, big men can really focus in on Cade from the help side when he's out there with Isaiah Stewart. That's just the reality of the situation. So does he get more efficient in the paint when he's playing with a guy who's more of a lob threat or a vertical threat next to him at the center position?
Yeah. So we talked about the bench. We talked about the bench scoring in particular. We talked about just like the defense scheme and personnel and scheme and scheme and scheme. And then we talked about Cade. Which of those three things needs to get fixed first, Ben? Like, you got the honey-do list. It's like the wife writes down like all the stuff that she needs you to do this weekend. It's like, all right, like, fix Cade efficiency, fix defensive scheme, fix bench offense. Which one goes first on the list?
Such a good question. I think for me, it would be, I don't think there's much you can do about the bench efficiency until you get your guy's healthy. So I think Burks, I don't know how much Dwell is going to play, but I think until you get Burks and Bagley back, you're limited. I don't think there's a lot of efficient scoring until you get Burks back. I think he's going to help. So I'm going to rule that one out by default just because we're not healthy. Cade efficiency. I mean, he's your most prolific shooter, right? And his efficiency is below league average. I would like to see that improve. I think in time that's going to improve. I think we just have to be patient. I remind myself, got to be patient with Cade. Just got to be patient with Cade's efficiency. Yep. It's a multi-year project for him, I think. Learning to score at the NBA level is going to take him some time. But I think aside all of that, I just don't think this team's offense well, let me phrase this a different way. I think this team has a better chance of being efficient offensively the more they run. They're already a faster-paced team, depending on if you're looking at Basketball Reference or NBA.com. They're in the top 10 in pace in the NBA, which is surprising to me already. That's going to make them better offensively by default just because they can run. And the better they are defensively, the more they will run. So what's interesting is they're top 10 pace and a bottom 10 defense. That's really unusual, right? Because typically you would see good defense, high pace, because good defense leads to transition. So anyway, my long way of answering this question is I would really like to see them get better defensively because I think that's going to help correct some of these other issues. And they just shouldn't be as bad defensively as they are. They just shouldn't be. They're not going to be a good defensive team, but they shouldn't be this bad. Because as we've talked about, I really do think the number of open looks they're giving up is preventable, at least to some of them are. Some of them certainly are, with some relatively simple corrections. So I'm going to say defense is on the top of my honey-do list. It's not going to be great, but it can certainly be better than it is right now.
Yeah. The thing I will say that I think that they can clean up immediately from a defensive perspective is the transition defense. The transition defense has been horrendous through three games. The Knicks were running up and down the floor every chance they got. They were doing the thing where, like, you would, like, Ivy would get a transition opportunity, he would convert, they'd take the ball out of the basket, immediately, like, throw it down court, and you're ending up in another transition opportunity right back. Like, that is unacceptable, and I do think that is low-hanging fruit for them to be able to clean up to get to a slightly better spot defensively. Like, if you're going to play fast, if you're going to play at a high pace, you have to be better at responding to teams trying to run it back down your throat. And so far, they haven't been able to do that. So I think that it's like, again, they're not going to change the switching scheme. They seem really stuck on it philosophically. But if you're going to improve defensively, the place I would start was with the transition defense, because that's just like getting back, getting matched up, like finding your guys and like effort running back in transition to be able to stop them. So we'll start there.
Yeah. And if you're fast enough to be a top 10 team in terms of offensive pace, you're fast enough to get going in the other direction like that. Easy.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Ben, last but not least, not fun story this week. Detroit Pistons assistant GM Rob Murphy was placed on leave after an alleged workplace misconduct involving a former female employee. It was reported by ESPN, confirmed by The Athletic, that the probe into the alleged misconduct is ongoing. And when asked about it, Dwayne Casey offered like no comment, basically said, the when the probe finishes, like we'll know what to do, but we're gonna let like the probe happen. Obviously this is not the kind of thing you want to have happen this early in the season or any time. This is not the type of thing you want to happen at any time. And we've seen how we've seen this happen this season in the NBA with the Ime Udoka situation. It's like, first of all, like I feel terrible for the female employee, the former female employee in question. Just like removing the sports element from it, like having a workplace dynamic where like you're offered like a quid pro quo, or like you're giving preferential treatment, or like you feel like that's something you have to do to progress your career. It's just like that's the type of stuff that like gets you sued from an organizational standpoint. And so it's like my heart goes out to her. There's also like, I completely understand like why the Pistons are handling this the way they're handling it. This is not something I would like want to be talking about. This is not something that I have like a ton of legal like insight into, but I do know that like this is not good, and like this is not the story you want to hear. And it's and not interesting, but like Rob Murphy is the guy that they had put out as a more public facing front office employee. You know, he's made an appearance on a couple podcasts. He's a Detroit guy. He has connections like to the Detroit area, coached at Eastern. Like, this is a guy that the community is familiar with. And so to have him be involved in something like this is extremely disappointing for somebody that they pushed as kind of a relatively public face of the Pistons front office. What was your reaction to the news, Ben? Like, this is like a Tuesday night like news drop thing, so it's just like, ugh, God.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to know what to say without any details or real knowledge. I think just speaking generally, on the one hand, it's a sign of progress that these sorts of allegations result in action, right? So 20 years ago, these kind of things immediately get swept under the rug and nothing happens. So as horrible it is that these things still happen, at least we live in the day and age where allegations are taken seriously. So I'm happy for that. On the other hand, that these situations continue to happen, that we still continue to live in a society and are fans of a league where female coaches and female referees and female executives are still incredibly in the minority, when it's very clear there are females who are eminently qualified for any number of positions within the league and within organizations, et cetera, and are still subject to this sort of, you know, we don't know if it's discrimination or harassment or whatever it is here. You know, all of that is still, you know, very clear evidence that we're not in the type of society we want to live in. We're not fans of the type of sports organizations that we want to be fans of yet, right? We're not living in the type of ideal society or equitable world that we might want to yet. I think, you know, the most I would want to say about, you know, this specific situation is, yet, like, one of the things to consider is whenever you've got any sort of workplace relationship is, there's always going to be power dynamics at play when you've got someone high up in an organization with a job title like this. Even in a situation where it's air quotes consensual, it's not consensual because there's an inherent power imbalance between someone with a big important job title and someone who doesn't have that big important job title. And that kind of thing's always wrong. It's never fully consensual. There's always something that's imbalanced about that kind of relationship. I hope that the team takes it seriously. I hope they don't sweep this away. And I hope that they're as honest with fans as they can be about what happened. And I hope that, you know, they're honest about condemning whatever it is that needs to be condemned, right? I just hope they make clear statements about the morality of the issue and not just legal corporate nonsense, right? Basketball is a wonderful sport. There's room in the NBA for smart, talented women, and it's sad that we continue to allow women to be treated this way, and I hope we stop doing it. I hope we stop doing it, Les. That's what I'm gonna say.
Absolutely. All right. With that, the schedule for this week, the Pistons play in Washington on Tuesday. Then they have three straight home games, a home series with the Atlanta Hawks, and they play the Warriors on Sunday night. That'll be fun. Ben, do the Pistons win a game this week? Are we staring at one of those Atlanta games as a possibility?
It's tough, man. Pistons perimeter defense has been pretty bad, and there's some pretty good perimeter players in those four games, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Pretty perimeter-oriented offense coming our way. Maybe one of the Atlanta games, man. I think that's what we're hoping for.
Yeah, the Wizards already beat the Pacers, and I think they're 2-1 right now. Don't think the Hawks have lost yet, but they've played like the Magic and some other teams. It was like, I can say that because we've beaten the Magic, right? If we had lost the Magic, I'd be like, oh god. But yeah, I would like to be able to get one of those Hawks games. It does seem like they have done a good job of attacking Trae Young, making Trae Young play defense in the past. I hope that continues, especially in a home and home. I would like to be able to get one win this week. They're going to need one win per week to avoid some of the morass that comes with like the 8-game, 12-game, 15-game losing streaks that can happen over the course of an NBA season with such a young team. So let's avoid that. Let's get one of these games this week. Maybe the Warriors will be nice and like sit half their team for, I guess, the Pistons because we're not a threat. All right, Ben. Let the people know where they can find you, where they can find your thoughts on this team during the game. You're a lot more excitable during games than you are on the pod. I like that, that personality, that dichotomy.
Yeah, my podcast self is... I've had time to process. My Twitter self is very much in the moment, which is why I automatically delete my tweets after X amount of days, because the in the moment Ben is raw and unfiltered. And yep. I don't think about things too much before I tweet them. By the time we get to the podcast, I've thought about things. I've processed things. I'm a little more rational. When I'm on Twitter, it's just like if it's as if we were sitting down watching the game together and I'm just reacting. So at BR Gulker on Twitter if you want the unfiltered Ben.
Yeah, and make sure you take the screen captures or
yeah. If you want the receipts, you're gonna have to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Of course you can follow me on Twitter and get my slightly less filtered but still kind of filtered unreactions. The reactions are for the DMs and the text messages. You guys aren't getting those. You can do that on Twitter at Last Chance. That's at LAZCHANCE. All right, everyone, thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Detroit Bad Boys podcast, and we will talk to you all next week. Feels good to be back on the schedule. See you then.